Welcome to another episode of the Bites of Wisdom podcast. I am one of your hosts, John Ballone. As a general reminder, we've begun to rebrand the podcast. Don't panic, we're just growing up. This new name better reflects the podcast as a brand and hopefully brings us to a much wider audience. All of these changes are happening automatically in the background, thanks to you, technology. Our guest for this episode is Scott Snowis, the CTO and head of engineering at SS&C Retirement Solutions. Scott and I have been working together for a number of years. His experience in technology, management, and executive leadership is what brings him here tonight. We have a great conversation ahead, so please sit back with a cup or mug of your favorite beverage and enjoy. Thank you for listening.
So I thought we'd start off real quick, or at least talk a little bit about my wiring my house. So as we were prepping here and testing a recording and doing some fun stuff, I think I'm once again delaying the uploads of these. But this week I went through two drill bits, two 65 foot runs of optical cable, and I finally ran Ethernet because I got so frustrated with myself. But of course, being the person that I am, because, you know, I'm running 65 feet of it, but it's outside, so I should buy outdoor cable. I bought 28 gauge outdoor cable for my Ethernet, and I ended up having to crimp it 8 times to finally figure out that this crimper doesn't work and the cable doesn't actually pinch down here. So the status of my of wiring is that the holes are drilled. There are cables physically from one point A to point B, but I am unable to actually cap that cable, at least until tomorrow afternoon.
I think we should start a GoFundMe, not because you need money, but just to find somebody to come do your cabling.
It's funny because the first thing I was really angry with myself for a lot of reasons. And, you know, the first thing is I messed my back up a few weeks ago, shoveling snow. And I sat underneath my house on a rock salt bucket, drilling holes to run this wire because I wanted it to be clean. I didn't want to have just wire dangling everywhere. And I did that for about 45 minutes and messed my back up again, my sciatica. And then after that whole thing, after I realized that this gauge cable is way too thick, I was like, I'm going to have to sit on this fucking podcast and explain this. So there was a brief point in time where I was like, thumbtack, can I get someone here just so I don't have to record a message telling people that I don't know how to crimp cable?
I'm going to confess, I do a lot less stupid stuff because I'm worried I might have to admit it on this podcast.
So that's been my week. And my wife, she probably thinks I'm crazy at this point.
How long have you been married?
8 years.
She already knows.
Yeah, she knows I'm crazy.
Yeah.
This is well understood.
My wife may make you invite me back so I do less stupid things.
The thing about this is that I didn't even realize that there existed 28 gauge cable. So I never would have thought that I need to buy like a different end crimper, even a different crimper. And I'm not even sure if the crimper that I or the crimp and the ends that I ordered are even going to work. So I'm really going in here blind.
Isn't there a YOLO chef script somewhere that does something like this?
Danger YOLO. It's actually, and it's a Ruby script that SSH is using Ruby, so net SSH, to a cluster that then runs Chef. So it's multiple layers.
Multiple layers of nothing ever goes wrong with Danger YOLO. Well, the voice everybody heard that we haven't introduced, but because we couldn't wait for John's story, is Scott. So John, let's introduce the person that's already been talking.
Yeah, Scott. So why don't you give us a little bit of about yourself? You know, you're currently, I'm going to just do a little intro for you. You're currently the CTO of
Oh, you want me to finish the sentence? Okay. Damn. So I'm currently the chief technology officer for retirement solutions at SS&C Technology. So a division of SS&C Technologies. And, you know, just briefly, I've been in the technology space, and specifically, you'll find out my career a little more, the defined contribution or employee benefit space for over 30 years, which, you know, I didn't plan to get into, but that's where I was. I started at Fidelity Investments. I worked there, or in this industry of Fidelity Investments. I had another job, but, you know, it's interesting, but a whole different conversation before that. And really started on the infrastructure, or, you know, desktop server engineering side, moved over to application development, and expanded, you know, kind of my responsibilities both for technology teams as well as kind of business products. And from there, after 17 years, I left at a good time when I had an opportunity to leave, to really figure out, like, did I know what I was talking about or not? And, you know, what I found out, and kind of bringing it back to my current role, is I knew a lot about the defined contribution space and technology in that space. And so I then worked at, I did consulting for a year, and where that was, again, another interesting thing coming right out of corporate, you know, kind of corporate technology, and then into consulting, where, you know, a company that might have previously been a competitor that wouldn't let me in the door was like, hey, tell us why, you know, why we need to fix things. But then ended up at Guardian Life, their CIO of retirement, then at Mercer for the CIO of US benefits. I went back to Fidelity for a couple of years to help them get their record keeping modernization program off the ground. And then to SS&C. So, you know, all through kind of corporate technology, and really in this space, I never thought I'd know anything about, but, you know, 401k, defined contribution, record keeping, and employee benefits.
That's a hell of a journey. That sounds like fun. I want to go all in on the tangent, but we got to focus a little bit. So I want to know about the consulting, but I want to know about the early years personally.
So as a, you know, like I think most of you, I don't know all your backgrounds, but I've listened to some of the stuff, but I'm a lifelong geek. And it started when I'm pretty sure it's 78, right? So you could tell I'm a little older, right? I don't know that I'm the oldest, but I think I'm the oldest in this call. I was at sleepaway camp, right? You know, and my father sent me a Polaroid picture of his new purchase, which was a TRS-80 Model 1 Micro. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, Micro, yes.
So just real quick, you're at sleepaway camp, 1978. Your father took a Polaroid photo and he mailed it to you?
Oh yeah, because when you were at sleepaway camp, like, you were like out of communications completely. The only way you could talk was, you know, letters. I guess you got a phone call. It was like jail. You get a phone call once a month or something.
So that still applies to today. Like, yeah, when you go to sleepaway camp, John, you'll find out.
I bet you're going to jail.
No. Well, I think the same thing still applies for jail as well. when your kids go away to sleepaway camp, they take your kids have to give up their cell phones and devices to the parents. The only way you can communicate is you can write a letter to the kids, but the kids are not allowed to write a letter back.
Wow, that's weird. That is a thing. I think the best part about this, though, is that the analog of what we do today, where we take photos of new gadgets and stuff and we throw it right up on Instagram.
Totally.
But I want to know why your father took a photo in a Polaroid and sent it to you in camp knowing you can't do anything. Was it torture? Was he knew you wanted it? Or was he just, he knew that there's going to be an engineering pick behind your personality?
It was a smart move by his dad.
Yes, it was.
Right. Well, it was a smart, the smarter move I'll tell you in a moment. But I think it was a couple things. Yes, he knew I'd be interested and excited. You know, I was always one of those kids who like took apart my toys, not, you know, not played with the toys, but took apart the toys. So he definitely, he was excited himself, right? And he wanted to share that excitement. And it was a little bit, haha, I have it all to myself, right? I'm sure there was a piece of that too. But you know, so obviously, you know, when camp ends and I get home, you know, he's had it only for maybe a couple of weeks. And so he's like, hey, this is it. This is cool. It's very expensive. I don't remember how much it cost at the time, but you know, they weren't cheap, set $1,978. So he's like, you know, you really like, I'll show you this and you can watch me. And so while I'm at work, like, don't come in my office, which was the thing he may have smartly knew I was going to disobey. And so the minute he left for work and I wasn't at school, I was using that thing nonstop. And, you know, it started with, and it's funny as I reminisce about it, like there was no internet, obviously. But the only way you could learn stuff was magazines that you'd have to wait to come in the mail or newsletters. And so, you know, I started by, you'd read a magazine that would have a program in it and it would be like, you know, hey, you know, this is a tic-tac-toe game. If you could type the whole thing, and you'd be like, I learned to, you know, hunt and peck type. and you go through that and, you know, you learned programming then by, well, I learned it, by copying someone else's stuff. It's GitHub all over again. And then changing it to figure out, you know, where it goes. And so, you know, the journey kind of went on from there. It sparked my interest, and, you know, I ended up, you know, kind of going through the Radio Shack line of computers. I got, a couple of years later, I got on my own the color computer. It was a 6809 based system, I think, and got more into it. And, you know, then the IBM PC and all that stuff. But I kind of stayed with it the whole, you know, time. And the other interesting thing that you all probably know, but I, you know, as the old man screaming at the clouds, I miss, is it was such a community back then. Like, so in addition to the magazines with TRS-80, like the only other place to talk to people about this stuff were like computer user groups, which you would physically go to and meet people. And we went to one at the local community college, but it was, you know, it crossed all lines of age and economics and whatever. It was just people interested in computers. And you went there to exchange, you know, what you knew, what you were doing, often software, like, you know, piracy was, you know, it wasn't really called that, but it was the, you know,
yeah,
it was,
oh, it was.
Yeah. Well, no, it was, but it was, you know, early it was just like, hey, I, you know, this stuff, but yeah, that was, you know, it was prevalent for sure.
Lotus 1-2-3 was one of the first things I might have, don't remember paying for.
Yeah. Right. Right. But it was amazing. And the community piece was great. And, you know, that, you know, I was then always branded as, you know, the geek or whatever, and, you know, helping, you know, as it became more prevalent in other people's homes, I was like, oh, call Scott. He can help. And again, you can interrupt me if I'm rambling. The other thing, so, you know, I went through high school. What I didn't do, and I know you had I didn't listen to the whole thing, but a podcast about higher education and its place here. I didn't go right to college, which was at the time, and definitely for my parents, horrifying and a betrayal. and in that time, it ended up being a year, my gap year. I tell my kids I invented the gap year, but I wasn't the only person. I actually was very lucky, but because of my interest in these people I knew through kind of coming up through the community, I was blessed, and I ended up working for a year at Bell Labs. You know, it was amazing. Yeah. And so this was AT&T Bell Labs. So it was kind of at the beginning of the end for Bell Labs, but it was unbelievable. And, you know, the people there and whatever were crazy smart. And they basically, not my parents, but they said, you know, you're going to have to go to school if you want to keep going in this thing. And lo and behold, I went to school.
That's the environment that, you know, I feel like if I had a time machine and I could go be somewhere, it would have been at Bell Labs in, like, you know, during that time period. And yes. I totally understand why why they also encouraged you to go back to school, which is just the lineage and the breed of the people there.
Right. Well, and I, it was also like you, you know, it was much more about in that time, like if you didn't, you couldn't get in the door without that credential. And, you know, they were like, hey, that, you should be here, not here literally, but in this environment, but you have to go through this, you know, you have to go through this first. Were you going to say something?
I was going to say something, but I forgot what it was. I just was trying to see if I could remember the timeline of some of the people that I met through the ages that came out of the place. But there were so many wonderful names that invented so much, at, particularly at those later years of 18 Tail Bell Labs, that don't get the name recognition, but they've gone on and they've developed wonderful compilers, wonderful software.
And that's just the software, like Lucent with a lot of the routers and stuff that they've built. Like, you know, over the years, the amount of, you know, it's the lineage of that whole, what I'm trying to remember. It's New Jersey, right? Bedminster? Bedminster? No.
Well, Holmdel, right. So yeah. And I wasn't in the Holmdel office, although I was nearby. I was in Long Branch, which was this small office, you know, kind of satellite, but it was actually fascinating. And it did relate to that job I didn't mention before. Like that was really my kind of first job out of college, was something because of this. But I ended up, you know, what was happening at 18T Bell Labs at the time, you know, I think it was like right after the breakup, it was AT&T. They were trying to figure out, you know, when they were a monopoly, they didn't have to figure out how to sell anything. You just had to buy their stuff. Right. And so they were, you know, they had amazing products, but they couldn't figure it out. So I ended up doing support of a product that was in, I'm trying to remember what they called it, of a venture division. But the product was a 16-bit grayscale scanner, right? That could, like, you know, scan stuff in 16-bit, but coupled with, it was a software, another hardware piece and software coupled with a modem that was, I forget the speed of the modem, but you know, it was, you know, like 56K or something, but that could do a multi-point connection on an AT&T bridge. So yeah, audio conference, but it was, but what you could do with the software and the scanner and the modem was a screen share type thing. So you could scan something, annotate over it.
That's awesome.
And no, talk. it was crazy. And right. And talk. And so, you know, it was like,
you can barely do that today.
Right. Right. And so, you know, that was kind of just crazy. But the product, you know, it didn't really go anywhere because they couldn't commercialize it. But what I ended up doing, just, you know, closing the loop on that story, there was a community college in Pennsylvania, Lackawanna Junior College, that they were working with Native American Indian reservations to try and figure out how could they get teaching from those schools to Native Indian reservations, which were underserved,
right?
You know, by teachers. And they were using this technology
that's wild.
Right. And the school got a grant from the Department of Housing and Urban Development to basically build out this program. And so I was coming out of college right as they got the grant. The Bell Labs stuff was getting worse. Like the division was kind of, you know, really kind of shrinking. And they actually said, why don't you call Scott? He could set it up for you. And
that's what I did.
And it was amazing. It was an amazing experience. Like, you know, well, that's one thing with my whole career. You know, I've had a lot of good luck and, you know, can't complain about it. But so, yeah, it was crazy. And, you know, it was rewarding for sure because, you know, they were basically able to deliver classes to areas that they couldn't. Unfortunately, after a year, you know, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, I'm trying to remember the timeline, sometime in the early 90s, you know, there were budget problems. It got cut. The grant got cut, and I had to find a real job. and then I started that other journey.
so you know, when you began that journey, you know, in record keeping and, you know, 401k and benefits management, did you just apply to a job or was there someone you knew? Like, how did you get involved?
I knew this thing was winding down. Again, showing my age, I looked at ads in the newspaper.
And I've done that before and I'm not that old.
So. Yeah. And I, you know, I applied kind of cold fidelity, you know, so, you know, at the risk of oversharing. So I grew up in Jersey. I think we established my Jersey connection, but I ended up in the Boston area after college because I followed a girl here. Not my wife, but, you know.
Life.
That is what it is, right? Anyhow, and, you know, in the Boston area, you know, Fidelity Investments is a giant employer. And particularly at the time, they were growing enormously. So, you know, if you had any aptitude and you know, could wear a suit because you had to wear a suit, you could, you know, you got a job. And that's how it started.
That's the one thing that I personally have never had to do, going to work every day, is wear a suit. And I couldn't imagine having to sit down and write code, you know, wearing the suit every day just to.
Yeah. I mean, so it's funny because the Bell Lab guys didn't, right? And actually the Bell Lab guys much more had the culture, not quite as, you know, of, you know, where we are today, where it's much more casual and stuff. But, you know, they'd still have, you know, it was still the time where, you know, you'd have a couple drinks at lunch and head back to work. And then you go into finance, right? And in Boston, and yeah, it's totally.
They do that all the time.
Well, they do it all the time, but everyone's wearing a suit and it's, it's like it was really a uniform, to tell you the truth. And that's, you know, so there was State Street and other places there. Right. And you knew people were in your industry because you were in the uniform and you would go to work. So you get used to it in some ways. You know, it was easy because you lined up your suits, you know, you went in and then you came home, dropped them at the dry cleaners and, you know, lather, rinse, repeat. But yeah, it was, you know, the winters, I was living in Boston at the time. You take the T and yeah, it sucked to be, you know, in the winter when it's snowing in a suit, you know, on your way to work. But you know, you had to do it. So you did it.
So tell us a little, sorry, Ozzy, were you going
to? I mean, you can go ahead. I was going to ask, and maybe you're going to ask something along the same lines. Scott, you just explained how you got into this whole benefits, employee benefits industry. But, you know, over your years, you seem to have stayed in that industry. What kept you in the industry? Is there any sort of special skills that you've developed, you know? You're in technology. I got to imagine there's no secret technology that they're using in that industry. So what kept you there over all these years?
Yeah. So it's a good question. I ask myself that sometimes. So a little bit of it is, I think I've been pigeonholed, but right. Like once you're doing it, but the reality is, and, you know, as I mentioned, when I left Fidelity and went other places and did consulting, I you know, what I value about now is I learned the business, right? So it's not about the technology, right? I understand the business. I understand the clients. I understand like why we do stuff, and I can speak the language of the industry. And so one, I think I was, you know, I've been a little pigeonholed. I think I could translate it, but it's easier for me to get excited and talk about, you know, kind of this space because it is so familiar to me. And frankly, that's what I think has, you know, let me get roles in different organizations because I am familiar with the domain and also the technology, but the business knowledge is really the thing that, you know, I think is why I've stayed and why other companies are like, oh yeah, maybe we'll talk to Scott.
Yeah. I thought it might be that. I thought it might also be maybe some regulatory expertise that you might pick up in that industry that might keep you there as well. But yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, go ahead.
No.
I was just going to say, yeah, regulatory. I mean, it's not, I mean, there is a lot of regulation. I wouldn't say it's, you know, the most complicated stuff. I think people can pick it up. I think the, the real nuance compared, you know, so Fidelity is a good example. Even inside my role in SS&C, we have platforms, you know, that do defined record keeping. That's what, you know, I'm responsible for, my teams. But we have teams, you know, that I'm not, that are doing brokerage and transfer agency, you know, also in finance and also like with a lot of the same terminology. But the difference is they're doing like kind of high, the trades are coming fast, and the velocity of the kind of the day-to-day work is one thing. In the defined contribution business and record keeping, most of the stuff's it's batch at night. Most of your 401k plans have mutual funds, so we don't get prices till after four. What's complicated about this industry is everyone's 401k plan has different rules.
Yes.
And within that, there's even more complexity, you know, based on, are you vested? Are you in office? Your age? Like, so that complexity and working through that is kind of what you learn how to think through, discuss, and kind of work with teams to develop over time. And so it's that niche of, hey, you understand the constructs in that space. And then how the, you know, the clients or the, you know, depending on when I worked at Fidelity, or the clients were real, the employers in SS&C, we sell our platform to people like Fidelity that use it to serve the employers. So it's kind of looking at the, you know, how it applies in, through those different facets.
You answered the question I was going to ask a little bit later, which is what makes it interesting and what draws you into it. And it sounds like the interesting part is the complexity of solving the employer's problems, not the complexity of managing the assets that are traditionally managed. It's a big bucket of mutual funds, big bucket of things, and you allocate them. The hard part is, okay, this sliver gets this pit, but they also have a different contract, and that can explode in complexity very, very quickly. And especially if, how do I say, well, I'm going to use the crude example I always go, hedge funds like to negotiate a lot.
Oh yeah. I mean, so it is all that complexity, you know, added on with, and everyone has it, the integrations, right? Because the whole thing with employee benefits is their payroll deductions. So you got to deal with the payroll providers and the whole flow of how does money get out of your paycheck, get to your benefit, you know, get to the right buckets in your benefit and stuff like that. It's, you know, it's always a fascinating thing. And the, you know, the shift over time of, you know, regulatory change. This is where regulation comes in, you know, trying to get more people access in defined contribution space. How do you get more participation? Both like automatically setting people up so they, you know, will actually save for retirement, and trying to, so last year, Secure 2.0 was passed, but the couple of years before Secure 1.0, these are kind of new regulations that are trying to open access with, part-time workers who are long-term part-time workers, making them eligible. And just if you think about that problem as an example, Jeremy,
it's
you need to track people's part-time hours over 3 years to determine if they're eligible to participate in their 401k plan. And
oh
so,
God.
Yeah, it's,
and they and they change hours, and they have all these nuanced deals where they're sitting there like, oh no, I had somebody work for me. And then, holy
Jesus. And then on top of that, right, you know, just again, looking at that example, it's, well, the company could set a vesting schedule. Many now just 100% vest them. Yep. But you could end up saying, oh no, I want to vest these people over 3 years. But is that 3 calendar years? Is that 3 years worth of service? Like, it's it goes on and on and on and on.
It's like not a Turing complete machine.
That's fascinating, the levels of complexity. I never thought in that space. I always thought about it from the mutual fund. Like, okay, they have a big basket of things and they don't change too much. They price them out. They send out a reconciliation once a month. Yay.
Right.
It's on me for not recognizing how much the complexity is there. That's fascinating.
Yeah. I think, I mean, it's always interesting because, you know, when you contrast it with people you have in other spaces in financial services, they're like, my stuff's really complicated. I'm like, I bet it is. It's different complicated. Right. And, yep. And right. And that's always the hard thing to say. Well, where is your nuance?
So, you know, in your years kind of moving within the same space, but moving from kind of individual contributor through to a CIO, head of engineering, what have you found, like, your skills, like, changing, and what skills have been the ones that have, you know, led to you being where you're at now?
I mean, you know, you're going to be unsurprised at my answer. So early on, right, it was technology skills. And frankly, that was more my interest. But as you, you know, as you get through it and your career progresses, like mine has, you can continue down that path. But, you know, it's kind of narrow, interesting, but narrow. You know, what ended up happening, you know, and Fidelity was the first time, you know, where I became a supervisor, but they were just growing so fast. So they're like, look, there's three people on your team. You can spell. You can spell. You're the manager.
Help.
You know, you develop the people skills. And I, you know, I think I have some natural people skills, but you learn the management skills, which are different than people skills. It's about, you know, how to really understand, you know, each individual, what they can bring to the team. Sometimes delivering tough messages about what they're not delivering or should be delivering. So, you know, that definitely helped me kind of get further on, and then further deepening, you know, my understanding of the business and just even like over time, particularly in like the CIO roles I've held, you need to understand the business. Like, you know, you need to understand the revenue and the, you know, operating income and like stuff that, well, my computer science degree, we didn't talk about, right? That was like, oh, I need to know a little bit of, you know, corporate accounting and what that means. And so, yeah, those are the skills that over time I had to develop beyond my technical skills. And I enjoyed, right? It's because it's interesting because then you could kind of see how, like what you do, which is pretty abstract. Like I write software that helps people put money in their 401k, which is a very like, you know, I'm proud to be in this industry. Don't get me wrong. But it's like abstract, but then you could see it. Oh, and this is how they make money. This is how we make money. This is how all the middlemen make money. Like it's interesting.
That's one of the things I think that, as a technologist that you don't learn or you're not told, you lose sight of quickly is that there's a capped amount of time when you're going to really be in the technology. You can be in the industry for a long time,
right?
But the percentage of time that you do working on technology starts to fade because it's natural, right? Like, and it's for different reasons. You either move into management,
right,
to advance your career, or just life takes over, right? Like you can't maintain pace with the 24-year-old, you know, kid that's just spending all his hours like in the basement, right? Spending all his hours in the basement, you know, banging away when your life has changed and you have other priorities and, you know, maybe marriage, kids. And that's the part that a lot of people probably don't know coming into the field and then quickly realize at some point.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely true. You know, it's also how, you know, I think I'm also wired to explore a little bit more of the, you know, in my current role, I deal more with clients. Like you can, like you start to learn all different angles. Some folks don't want it. And by the way, we need them, right? I need people to sit down and be heads down and code, but you also need the people to kind of connect. But yeah, at any level, you know, I've seen it, you know, even the, you know, kind of the junior engineer that grows into your, you know, your best architect, you're not hands-on keyboard coding anymore, just because once you build some body of knowledge, be it about the industry or even about the technology or the platform, your value is you sharing that knowledge, not typing the code. And so that kind of, you know, is where you end up going. Don't get me wrong. I miss, like, there is something beautiful about being able to write some code and see some output and be like, oh, that's done. And, you know, wherever I can, I tinker in my
mission
day
accomplished.
Job. Right. Exactly. But it's also, also fulfilling seeing a team that kind of you gave some, you know, some direction to actually get over the finish line and have done it. And frankly, oftentimes better than you imagined it because they kind of could take what they bring to the table.
Yeah, I was just going to say real quick, I don't think I've met one technologist, coder, security person that is in this phase in their career that didn't say, man, I miss those days.
Yeah.
I miss those days of just being able to kind of plug away and code or just play with technology.
But the hard part is always humans. They're more complicated than any amount of code I've ever seen. And that's the more interesting part for me. And I'm, sounds like it is for everybody here.
So I got a quick question before we kind of move to a different topic. If someone wants to get you to do something or wants to get you interested, is one of the quickest ways to get you to do so to tell you that, you know, it's not possible?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I know it is for Jeremy.
Yeah.
I know it is for me.
Yeah. Or I tried this. You can't be done. What?
You're right. I mean,
so
quickly, hold my beer.
Hold my beer. Right. So quickly on that point, and I know you're more of your history than we've talked about today. And I know you've spent a lot of time understanding the architecture of systems and kind of extracting that architecture into a more modern platform. What's some of the innovation you see happening in your space, like today and in the next 5 years? Like, what excites you the most?
Wow, that's a big question. In this space in particular, and you do, you know, you're leading me a little bit because you know, but you know, these systems for the industry I'm in, they were built on the mainframe, you know, 30 plus years ago. And you know, I'm not, you know, there's always the extremes. People are like, oh, the mainframe, where at? Right. But first of all, the mainframe was the first private cloud, right?
It's an amazing piece of technology today and still one of the best integrated platforms I've ever built software on.
It's amazing. It scales and whatever. And so what's exciting and interesting is seeing how to translate that work to the distributed space. And what's exciting, right? So, you know, the big knock on why people want to get off the mainframes is, you know, it's proprietary technology effectively. And now you can move to kind of fully open source distributed workloads you can bring everywhere. And on top of that, right, you know, there's so much more capability today. You know, in the old systems, it had to be, you know, a transactional system, an analytical system, like everything was just one big lump. And now, right, you can kind of break things apart, still do things at massive scale. So I think, you know, that's amazing. And for this industry specifically, I think that's exciting, but it's also really hard. It's really hard to take people who've, you know how to build on a monolithic architecture, for lack of a better term, and do what's distributed. But I'm excited, you know, everyone's going to say about like, what can we do with, you know, new AI and how that works. I don't think that's going to, and John and I, you and I have had this conversation. There is no AI yet that's going to take the big COBOL application and write it in the future state. But as far as, you know, helping, I think there's a role for that. So I'm excited about that innovation. I also think just there's way different ways. And I'm, you know, I haven't even completed my thing about this, but, you know, when you talk about the edge, you know, the getting data closer to the end customer and what you can do now, because in this space, employee benefits, as I told you, there's kind of different customers. One of them is the, you know, the 401k provider, and they want all the data on their clients, but their clients, the plan sponsors, they want the data close to them and then their employees. And I think like just the ability to give those different levels of data and flexibility and customization, like no one's doing it, by the way, but we're better equipped today than ever before just because of the way the technology there. So I'm kind of excited about, you know, what's possible.
So I have a question about that because the monolith has a lot of choices removed. So as an architecture, you're kind of forced to make decisions within that. And that's a benefit sometimes too. It means you don't get an explosion in scale. You don't have to decide between 16 different microservices, 14 programming languages, and whatever is hot on Hacker News being what your developers are demanding to work on. So how do you, coming out of that world, start thinking about managing that new explosion in space and that new complexity of like, hey, there's 45 new languages that were released last year and they want to try out three of them. How do you think about that?
So block Hacker News.
I would love that, but they still pull up their phone and they're gonna be like, ooh.
Right. Well, so not in my current role, but in kind of quote classic corporations like Fidelity and other places I've been, part of the way they solve that problem is literally a mandate, like you're only going to use Java and you're only going to use, right? So some of that stuff, you can remove choice just, you know, by fiat. And you know, I don't know that that's always the right way, but that's a way, and it's actually the way a lot of companies do it. I think the real answer to your question is it's really hard. You need, you know, if you're loosely following domain-driven design or something, you got to kind of draw domain boundaries and test them through people who understand the business and what, you know, when do you kind of cross over and not. And the other thing I think is you can't be a zealot. You can't religiously follow any of these kind of patterns, be it domain-driven design or whatever. You know, sometimes there's just, hey, 80% of the time it fits here. Good enough for me. It doesn't need to be its own separate thing. But I mean, frankly, I think that is the hardest part of modernizing right now, is figuring out how do you break it apart. And to your point, counter, you know, this has died down a lot, but the blogs and things that were all, you know, microservices, you know, make everything, you know, so small. Or going back to
functions,
right. Or going back to, you know, monolithic, you know, it's finding the balance. And I think that's part of what you learn through your career anyway. You know, I was much more an idealist when I started, like there is a way, right? One way, right? Whatever it was, more like a religion, if you will, like, you know, this is the way you do it. And then as you come over time, you're like, all right, the world's a little grayer than I thought, you know, just like my hair, right? Like, oh, there's a couple ways to do it, and let's pick a good one.
Doesn't Kubernetes solve it all?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Trigger warning for Jeremy. Trigger warning for Jeremy. That's been my experience, but I've been finding that limiting experimentation is probably my preferred method, is that you can't have it. 14 experiments going on with a team of 20. You can maybe have one, and then you have to see if it's valuable and returns the advantage. But you need goals. You need to quantify it. I like the top-down method also, like all Java, but I found that if you put it in the team, but you limit the number of experimentations at the same time is really useful. But they're going to get pushback no matter what. There's too many shiny objects, too much fun. And it just takes good old-fashioned management. You got to push things. You got to give things. You got to take things.
Right.
I do think there's a balance, and you know, one of the things that you know, I think limiting experimentation actually is extremely good at both the team level and personal level, right? So if you're starting on a new experiment, you should time box it. You should absolutely say, you know, I'm going to take, I don't know, 2 days. If you're talking through a sprint, then maybe a few days, like a quarter of the sprint, right? If it's half, you know, a week or two of a sprint. And do your experimentation, but then fully expect to throw it away or to have to refactor it in order to get it to a place where it could be leveraged by a larger team. But, you know, I think, and I know we've all probably experienced this, at larger organizations, if there's that secondary layer of looking at your landscape of products and services and other things, and you do the same thing at that layer, and you slowly rotate things out, and you know, you do things like make them available over services or databases, so that now you have consistent views that other teams can take advantage of. That's really how you build organizations where you limit the amount you could maximize your experimentation, but limit the amount of just pushing the same papers or bits around.
I agree.
It's not easy.
It's hard. I mean, you got to get the incentives right. You know, the hard part in, you know, kind of corporate America is, you know, part of it is, as you mentioned before, you got to be willing to, you know, walk away from some experiments. Throwaway is a dirty word. Like, wait, why did we invest any time? Well, you know, learning isn't valued as much as, you know, kind of working code, even though it's going to make the next code. And then it's, you know, I agree with what you're saying. I think it is hard. You know, it's always a people problem, I think Jeremy was trying to say earlier. It's how do you incent people? How do you make sure people want to share, are incented to participate in that ecosystem, as opposed to hoard kind of what their knowledge is? You know, it's, I don't know that anyone's perfectly cracked the code.
Definitely not.
So moving a little bit away from the more serious and professional life topics, what are some hobbies you have? What are things that you, I mean, I know that's fully saying some of the stuff that you're going to say, but I think it'll be an interesting thing to for us all to talk about.
Sure. So I started with, and I think I have established myself as a lifelong geek. So naturally the things that I like to do in my time are really, geeky type things. So video games, still at my advanced age, I very much enjoy, team shooters or other games, although I have a stint now where I'm going through single player games on the PS5. So that's like my new relaxing thing. But outside of that, the problem solving, the tinkering, the like learning stuff, I have a 3D printer. I like to, all the trends that you see come through about that stuff, these single board, microcontrollers like the ESP32. I like tinkering with those and trying to solve problems. Nothing that ever probably lasts. My one project that survived the longest is the one monitoring the depth of water in my sump pit in the basement.
I remember this conversation.
Right. Right.
Home assistant?
No. So it was home assistant. For that purpose, I had a home assistant set up and I had it connected to my, my lights, my whatever. And I found that it was fine, but I didn't actually use the home assistant interface that much. I actually use, kind of the Echo to mostly, most, I have kind of a boring, I did a lot of exciting stuff, but I found I didn't use it. And, you have to have the wife acceptance factor. So I'm pretty much down to, the switches work by controlling it with your voice, which is the most practical and most effective. And so when that happened, I kind of dialed it back. Right now, I have an ESP, I think it's an 8266 because I built it a while ago, but it's sitting in with a sonic distance sensor at the top of my motion pit, at my sump pit, and basically measuring the level of water. And then it sends the data to Prometheus, and I have a Grafana dashboard and alerting that tell me when there's a problem.
So what was the highest data points you've seen on your sump pit?
So it's in, I have it reporting in meters. So it typically, when it gets to 0.27 meters, it pumps, it empties the pump. But it was like 0.34. I had a problem last Christmas where, the water I get is seasonal. Like it comes in when we get snow melt or a lot of rain that raises the groundwater level. And so we had this, situation, and then the sump pump will pump like nonstop. And what basically happened, and this was a flaw in my, in my setup, I didn't have enough resiliency here. The plug for the sump pit is actually plugged into an outlet in the ceiling. You need to know this because it had been pumping so much, and I know it vibrated itself out. And the plug for the sump pump was also the plug I plugged my sensor into. So my sensor stopped sending readings.
The same time.
I didn't have an alert for
no data.
And so for a couple hours, I had a problem until my other, my belt and suspenders. I do have a, water sensor in the basement that has an audible alarm. I finished watching whatever movie I was watching. I'm like, oh, I thought I heard that during the movie. Anyhow, then I turned it back on and the pit was filled to the top. So whatever the top level was, the thing. But it should have told me before that, but I never, it unplugged itself. And the reality is it's my own fault because the sump pump actually has a battery backup, but it has a pump that can only go for like 30 minutes. But that pump's powered by a 12 volt battery. And when I put the thing in, I'm like, that'll be phase B, wire it to the 12 volt battery. So it will always have power. And I paid the price.
DR planning. I'll get to that next week.
Well, you know, I literally have a standby sump pump, like with like the piping ready to go. There's a check valve that you connect it to so that the stuff doesn't go. It's got everything and the check valve that all you need to do if my current pump goes, pull it out, drop the new one in and plug it in. Like I thought about this stuff, except for that scenario, right?
The hot swap.
Right. It's a hot swap. It's ready to roll. So, and then, you know, like I said, 3D printing has been an on again, off again thing. You know, part of, I think I mentioned earlier, when I got into computing, there were like these communities around it that, so I gravitate towards whatever the next technical communities that's emerging, right? Be it the little microcontrollers or the 3D printing. Like, I like that kind of, you know, there's all the sharing and a explosion of people doing new things. And so that's, if I analyze it, those are the kind of places I tend to tinker when the opportunities present themselves.
So drones?
I, very early, but not deeply. Yes. Okay. I did a little of that. Yeah. I literally was thinking about it the other day, but fixed wing, I think I want to do it. So I, you fixed know, the ones awesome. With, I yeah. haven't done fixed wing. I did a little, you know, the quadcopter thing, but now I think the fixed wings seem like, that's kind of cool.
That's the FPV stuff, the fixed wing FPV, those mini drones, about $140. They're really fast. Well, or are you talking about a different kind?
I'm talking about the ones that are like planes.
I was thinking more. I'm sorry. I was thinking about the racing FPV. Those things are bonkers.
Oh yeah. Those are crazy. And that's like the first person. No, these are like the ones that, you know, they're easier to control, but you have to go further distance and stuff like that.
Oh, I'll look that up because I don't know about those. It's more than RC planes, but.
Is it like the ones the military uses, like smaller?
Much smaller versions, but yes. Yes. Yeah. Much smaller versions, but yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, now they have like, it's amazing what you can get on these things, right? They have GPS, they can control themselves, you know, all that.
I have one of the little DJI ones that, I got it for Black Friday just to show my kids, hey, look, it's a plane. And we use the phone and there's a little controller.
Right.
And it's crazy the amount of like, so something that's 200 and I believe it's 249 grams without the battery.
It has to be.
Yeah, it has to be. And for something that big, it has a gimbal 4K or a gimbal 2K camera, GPS, like an RF signal that can pretty much go, you know, easy half a mile out of sight, probably more. And I've gotten that drone up to like 75 or 90 feet in the air. Like, it's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
It's amazing what they're able to do with those. Like some of the DJI stuff, their average is 7 kilometer range nowadays. You don't need a line of sight. Oof. And I mean, and if they don't have the GPS, they now just fly back to where they started and sit down because they're like, look, we don't know if we're in a controlled airspace. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah. Well, so the interesting thing about the DJIs is that all of the, at least from what I've been able to tell, all of the logic for controlled airspace, it actually is in the remote. So you can send a signal to let the drone know that it's not. And I'm not saying I've done this, but you could basically tell the drone that there is no controlled airspace.
Right.
I wouldn't want that.
Yeah.
What's this? The Suron e-bike? Have you guys seen those?
No.
They're basically just a class 2 e-bike. The key thing about a clean class 2 is it can go on any street in America. Class 3, you need to get a license because it's got so much power. They make it with a little inside the wire bundle that goes to the seat. There's this green loop wire that just kind of comes up and loops back down. If that wire is connected, it's a class 3 bike. If it's not, it's not. So you literally watch people go, they buy it, they cut the cable, they put tape on it, and then they go, great, I can go 70 miles an hour on my e-bike.
Right.
Wow. No,
you got to watch some of this stuff. It is insane what you can do with these e-bikes now. I wanted to buy one for my son, but my wife is like, hell to the no. He's not riding a freaking motocross. I'm like, it's electric. He's like, she's not doing motocross.
It's electric. I found out that my electric vehicle has a launch mode. I don't have a Tesla, but it has the ability to basically from a standing stop, like you hit the brake and then you hit it at a certain pressure and then you basically hit a button and it'll launch 0 to 60 with the rear motor.
That's a big car.
It's a big car. Sorry, Ozzy, I interrupted.
No, I was just going to say, Jeremy, we know somebody that builds, I think he builds e-bikes or is it scooters or something like that, right?
I did not know that. I'll have to ask.
Yeah.
I'll have to ask you because I want a name now. I want to go investigate this.
Yeah. We'll talk about it.
Yeah, that personal, you know, this battery tech and the motors are just getting amazing. My youngest has he's 22, so he's not that young, but he, you know, has one of those one wheels, and that's also scary.
One wheel, like a tricycle, like a
no. The balancing skateboard.
Single wheel, two like little areas, like a little platform, put your feet on, and
right.
Yeah.
Those things, I see people fly around New York City with those things. And I'm like, what? First of all, if you don't have a helmet and all the padding with those things, you're crazy.
Right. Yes.
So I used to ride an air wheel.
What is an air wheel?
You guys ever seen those? It's a unicycle, but you stand over it. It's not the skateboard one. You put your feet on the left and right inside of it and you lean forward to go forward by falling perpetually. And then it catches up and pushes your feet underneath you. It's insane.
This sounds very similar, and they are crazy. And if like,
how fast do they go? I mean, I've seen them before, but I don't think I've ever actually.
People started modifying them. So like you could get this one up to around 15 miles an hour, the one I had, which was booking. People have some modified ones that they imported that they're going up to 40 miles an hour. Oh yeah. You can go to YouTube and Reddit and find all the air wheel accidents where they're passing traffic and then somebody opens a door and just
even in New York City, imagine hitting like a pothole. And
I've hit a pothole on my motorcycle in New York City,
right?
And
yeah, this is not a motorcycle. This is a single wheel that you're standing on,
right? Right. And you just go for it. Yeah, I mean, my son actually hit a pothole in his high school parking lot when he had it, and you know, he's got he had a helmet on and he had pads on, but even so, right, he's got a nice scar from his trip.
In your era, Scott, and are the traffic regulations, like, are they able to ride that on a public road?
So it's funny. I don't know specifically the regulations. You have to ride. He's ridden by the police were always fascinated by him because, you know, he'd ride around town, but he'd mostly stay on the sidewalks. Yeah. Because I think it can go up to 12 miles an hour, but you know,
still fast.
Even that's crazy fast.
Yeah.
Right. Scare fast. So he'd go slower. They're not as common, you know, I'm in the suburbs, you know, outside of Boston. I think technically they're regulated like scooters. Like, you know, you got to ride them like scooters. You can't go on a highway with them, but you could go on the local roads.
And it's in a weird sort of gray area, right? It's not, shouldn't be on a sidewalk with pedestrians.
Right. Cause you can hurt someone for sure. Yeah.
Right. And then it's, you're going to be on a road where you're not going to be going fast enough for like traffic and, you know, it's a very gray, weird gray area. Here in the city, the problem is that a lot of people go on the bike lanes. Like I live, you know, on the west side of the city, and they have a bike path that goes all the way up from downtown Battery Park all the way up to, like, you know, the GW Bridge. And it's supposed to be just for bikes, but, and rollerblades. But you have J joggers, you have people on scooters, you have people on like scooters, like
power,
like
scooters.
Vespa scooters,
right?
Like,
oh, those, yeah, yeah.
Gas powered scooters.
I did, yeah, not, yeah, yeah, that. And then, you know, the single wheel standing thingies, whatever you call them.
Right.
So, yeah.
So we're getting to the end here. And one of the things, you know, we've asked a few folks, and I'm curious to see where you're outside of technology. And I know that's a hard thing to say, because technology is everything. Right? But outside of, you know, IT, let's say, information technology, software development. What is a trend or something happening that interests you the most?
Ooh, outside. I mean, that's
whatever you would define. I'm trying not to talk about Kubernetes and AI.
Can I talk about? I mean, so
talk about whatever you want.
Well, anything. Okay. All right. Well, but I mean, I'm going to cheat because it is a little bit of AI, but it's about the. I mean, we're at a weird time, right? And I don't know if it interests me, not necessarily in a positive way. It's more a, you know, curious way. It could be, but we still don't know the impact of social media on, right? Like on society, right? And, you know, again, I have my own opinions and whatnot. I mean, in a nutshell.
Oh, so do we.
Right.
But we gave them here.
Right. Yeah. In a nutshell, right? The thing that's been hard is people have always had their differences, and that's fine. But when people used to get together, and now I'm going to, again, be the old man shouting at clouds, like in the computer club and other stuff, you also had a lot in common. So like those things are kind of where you could kind of come together, but social media, right? It just, you know, amplifies the differences and you don't have the place to share the things. Now compound that with what's happening with AI and, you know, the generative photos and videos.
Scary.
Right? That's the stuff that I don't know that I'm, you know, excited, but I'm really curious to see where this goes and how we respond. And, you know, I think that's a big, you know, it's something we're all going to have to deal with. The kids are going to have to deal with that. You know, we got to get our arms around. So it's a trend. I don't know how it plays out. You know, but it is scary. But, you know, many old men like myself, not that I'm an old man, right, have talked about why, you know, the end of the world is coming, and we've always rallied. So
I'm an old man yelling, get off my lawn too. And right. I'm not that old, because I'm looking at some of this stuff and I'm sitting here going like, really? Do we really need to try to experiment with all of society at once, with everything all at the same time, because we can? Maybe let's see how something turns out before we fucking move on to the next crazy thing.
But maybe I should balance it with, but on the flip side, right? And this is all technology, but whatever. I'm not following the rules. I'm a politician today. I'll answer the question I want to answer. look at what is possible potentially in medicine and the innovation and stuff coming there. I mean, there, you know, the rapid development of some of these, you know, new vaccines or treatments that are possible because of that, that's pretty freaking cool. So, you know, like everything, it's all how you use it. And I think we, you know, we'll have to figure it out, and, you know, we'll get some right, we'll get some wrong. But, you know, it's an exciting time. You know, I guess it's always an exciting time, but it seems like it's faster and faster and faster.
If you were asking me that question right now, I would have gone with with all the nonsense going on in the UK with the royal family and Kate Middleton.
Yeah,
right. Oh. I just got sucked in today. I've been seeing stuff on Twitter and I've not paid attention.
Well, you were there last week too, right?
Yeah. And then I didn't hear anything about it when I was there. And today I got sucked in and I'm like, wow, this is fascinating. She hasn't been seen since December.
But I thought that she hasn't been publicly seen. Like, I thought they've seen her in cars and stuff.
So there was a picture of her in a car.
Right.
But, and then she, after a lot of commotion, she released a picture of her and the kids. But then
people
quickly were able to ascertain that the picture was Photoshop. Then she came out with a public statement saying, oh, you know, I'm an amateur at Photoshopping. And the commotion around that is like, wait, the royal family has butlers for their butlers. Right. You did not Photoshop this yourself. Like, what's going on here? Right.
But the crazy thing between those two things, you know, the point that she were, the royal family issued that letter explaining it, and the point that they sent it out, what blew my mind, and again, being the American I am, they sent a kill order for the photo to all of the news outlets. Like, and they told them that you must stop showing this photo because it is making the royal family look foolish.
There's a Spanish journalist who says she has sources close to Kate Middleton that the sources claim that she's in a coma right now. And the royal family, the royal family never responds to any speculation, but they went after the Spanish journalist.
The only time they generally do is when there's a problem.
Exactly.
Oh, now you're going to send me down an internet rabbit hole.
Oh, dude.
Yeah, thank you, Ozzy. I'm going to doomscroll all night.
Yeah.
I am there. Like, and William been having problems. William, the rumors say that, you know, he's been cheating allegedly, you know, with a friend of hers. So there's a whole lot going on.
What have you
been
reading?
Right.
It sounds like the National Enquirer.
Reddit r/conspiracy.
This is Twitter just today.
Really?
On my train ride home.
Wow.
I am so glad I know none of this.
Well, now you do.
Right.
I'm not going to search it up and I'm done.
Brings up such fascinating things. One, why would they cover up? But more, does the family deserve privacy? Let's say that's true. Like, you know,
that's another rabbit hole because what's quickly happening is, like, the press in the UK are saying, oh, Meghan, you should be coming to her defense, Meghan Markle. And people are like, wait a minute.
Wait,
right.
What?
Wait, right. What?
All exactly. The shit she dealt with? What?
Right. And then when Meghan Markle, you know, revealed that, you know, she had like suicidal tendencies and thoughts and, you know, she was going through a lot of trauma and stress. And the press was like, listen, you know what you signed up for.
You got to deal with it. Suck it up.
Right. Right. So now they're saying this is a matter of like health. We should give her space. And, you know, yeah. It's very fascinating. Anyway, sorry. I'm the time cop keeping us over by it.
But I mean, that was actually when you know, you, that was the first thing that I thought of too this week. That, and again, I didn't realize there was this whole, like, I knew that she had gone to the hospital for some procedure and that she was been, they said out of the public day-to-day activities until Easter. But I didn't realize it was like this whole sub-conspiracy. True or not, like, I don't know anything about it. But it sounds like they just seem to always be wrapped up in this, like...
Well, that's the history of royals. I mean...
Yeah. But listen,
they're prepping seasons of all the Netflix series, right? The
future Crown, right?
The Crown.
When you start going down the rabbit hole of like, all right, this might be like a little bit far-fetched conspiracy theories. Listen, the family can solve this very quickly. Wheel her out. Wheel her out in a wheelchair.
With a newspaper.
And be like, you know, and say, listen, I'm fine. I'm just still recovering. Thank you for your concern.
Right.
That's going back inside now.
And honestly, Jimmy Carter fucking did it. Like...
Yeah.
That dude, like, he's
right.
So
if just for future, if you want to talk about because now that you've got me on the tangent, what are mysteries you're thinking about? I still think about, did you hear about those guys after the Super Bowl in Kansas City? They went to see the Super Bowl, four guys. They went to their buddy's house.
Yes.
Right. This is crazy. This is a crazy story.
I don't know what you're talking about.
So
tell me.
Allegedly, like, everything was cool.
I don't mean to cut you off, Scott, but I don't know how I stumbled across this thing, it's weird.
So, you know, they went, the three friends leave the one friend's house.
Okay.
After the Super Bowl, you know, and it was cold during the Super Bowl, whatever. And then the next day, one of the girlfriends just comes looking for the boyfriend because he never came home. They find the three friends frozen to death in the first friend's backyard. But he alleges they left and whatever. And they still can't explain what the hell happened.
Frozen to death.
Yes.
First of all, like,
yes.
That isn't exactly easy to have.
Wait.
Yeah. Has anybody seen True Detective?
Yes.
Most recent season?
Yes. No, like, I haven't. Don't Detective. Ruin it.
Yeah. Yeah.
No yeah. spoiler. No spoiler, but a la True Detective. Yeah.
I got to watch this right. now.
But anyway, it's like crazy. And, you know, I think they were originally reported as frozen to death, but they never really, like, how crazy is that? In his yard.
Yeah.
The other crazy thing is, how do you not know there's three dead guys in your backyard? That's, I mean, you know, it's suspicious.
I mean,
well into the next day.
Could be big, right? Like I'm not defending the guy here that may or may not have killed these people or turned them into icicles, but like if it's like a 5-acre property, like, you know.
Yes, true.
I don't think it was a very
big property at all.
It's like the row house.
Right.
Like I think there was a picture on a story.
But I actually do think one of the three was found on like the back steps. So maybe the other two were in the back 40, but
I gotta look into this.
Yeah.
It's so crazy. So, yeah.
We got some reading to do tonight. Ozzy, thank you. Man. I'm gonna doom scroll.
Exactly. Okay.
You're welcome.
All right, listen, well, Scott, thank you.
Thank you guys for having me. It was great
thank
to chat.
Thank you very much. Thank you. A lot of fun.
All right.
Thank you for listening to another episode of our podcast. To support us, please subscribe on LinkedIn, Apple, Spotify, and YouTube. We love feedback. You can reach us at feedback@biteswisdom.com. Until next time, stay curious.